call the Senate Education Committee to order and give the gavel to Senator Stump.
Thank you, Senator Olson. This brings back old memories. As long as I don't get carried away.
We won't let him.
Okay. Senator Olson has Senate File 643 relating to the permanent school fund. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This is, I'm not trying to push to the front of the line, but this is just a little warm up for what's coming. And it is, Senator Sendrum was delayed a little bit, and I think Senator Hand may be too, so hopefully we can. That they will be here to continue on. But I took the agenda and not the bill. So the bill,
copy.
Senate File 643, is an amendment to it's a technical amendment to the what is defined as income earnings for the permanent school trust fund. Thank you. And at this point, it's interest on debt securities and dividends on equity securities. But this adds a clarification that apparently there's been some confusion about, and the interest earned on certified monthly earnings prior to transfer to the Department of Education. The interest earnings are the source of the funds that go to the department for distribution to the schools. A few years back, we changed the practice. For those of you who are new, we changed the practice of having it just rolled into the basic formula and nobody really knowing what we were getting from our interest on the corpus, the earnings on the corpus of the permanent school trust fund. And that we changed, and it's thanks to the efforts of folks. And I give particular credit, I think, to Grace Schwab and her then, and now Grace Kelleher, working with the School Board Association to give that as an additional source of funding so that people knew that what was coming from the Permanent School Trust Fund. So this just clarifies that the interest that's earned on certified monthly earnings prior to that transfer also is in the definition of calculation of income. I don't know if there's any questions.
Is there a committee that has some oversight over the fund?
There is in statute. We've created an advisory council to DNR for the management of the school trust fund lands. And I've attended the first couple of meetings. It's only chairs of the committees, so it has all been majority members, and I think there's some discussion of changing that membership too. But the folks that are really adding a lot to it are some of the citizen members or that represent. We've got a former commissioner, I think he was. I know he was deputy commissioner, Ron Nargang from DNR, and Gene Merriam, and there are several others that have good experience from different aspects of the minerals and forestry. And they have one of the things that they have done that's kind of exciting, and I hope we'll be able to hearing more detail of it, is working with negotiating with the federal government to exchange lands that we have that are like in the boundary waters and in federal parks that are generating nothing for the school trust fund, either negotiating sale or exchange. And I think they're coming up with a combination of both. And we do have one of the things, if some of the mining proposals that are before us come, there's a fair acreage that are on those lands that could generate upwards in the billions for the school trust fund corpus over a period of time. So there's, I think there's some good prospects ahead to getting better better return on our school trust fund lands that we still have available that haven't been sold, and also in the case of being paid for some of the ones that we're getting absolutely nothing from, and actually get some earnings from that money as well. So,
Senator Olson, do you know, has the advisory committee submitted a report? They were supposed to submit a report by January 15th of each year. I haven't seen that, but...
Mr. Chair, I have no idea about that. The chairs have been in the House, the past one have been House members, and I think the current one that was elected also is a House member. And so I'm not sure where that is. But I can certainly check. I do believe we have another bill or two that relates to permanent school trust funds, so we will be spending a little bit more time on this issue as before the end of session.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, having been the author of the legislation to create that committee, and as well as the redirection, I am aware that there was a draft report that was put together, and it had a number of recommendations. Senator Olson, you're exactly correct about the incredible potential in this fund. And we expanded the membership to help provide a greater perspective on those opportunities. So I look forward to those suggestions. One of the suggestions is looking at the Utah model, and I believe Senator Thompson is introducing a bill soon on that, and I believe I am a co-author. Perhaps you are as well, and that will give us a number of insights on potential school use of these dollars.
Great. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Senator.
If there's...
any other questions on Senate File 643? If not, Senator Olson?
I'd like to move that Senate File 643 be recommended to pass. I think... Does this need to be included in the omnibus bill? Probably just as well.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 643 be recommended to be passed and included in the omnibus education bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And I think I see at least one of the authors here for the additional bills. So.
Okay, Senator Hahn.
You got quite the portfolio. Got one in each committee today?
Yeah, we're
welcome. Yeah, it's Sarah Daly's birthday.
Is that going to be a job?
Senator Hahn, you have two bills. Is there which one would you like to take first?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think we should deal with 747 first. I think there's a few things there that I was just speaking to Mr. Schneiderwind, who was informing me of an amendment that I'd like to offer as an author's amendment, if I might. And this would be an oral amendment.
Okay.
Two components to it. One is on page 2, line 2.10. The word arbitration should be changed to arbitrator. And then over on page 4, line 4.9, it where it's starting with the number 9 on that line, that 9 should be stricken and replaced with 13 by a period, and then the rest of that sentence would be stricken, as well as the portions of 4.10 that are currently not stricken. So it would just replace 9 with 13, put a period, and then strike the remaining language on that line and the following line that is not stricken. And I believe that is the substance of the author's amendment that I'd like to offer.
Madam Chair, if I may, I just don't have a copy of the bill. If I may ask for a copy.
A copy of the bill?
I don't have a bill in my packet.
Ms. Yonkers, if you could report the amendment back, if you don't mind.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, the first part of the amendment is page 2, line 10. I believe you can reinstate an arbitrator and delete arbitration. And then the next amendment, Madam Chair and members, is on page 4. And line 9, strike everything after subdivision. And then on line 10, you can strike under subdivision. So then you'd keep that 13 in the period there on line 10.
Oh, okay. Senator Torres, have you got a copy now?
I do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Hand moves the amendment, the author's amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator File 747 is a bill that was brought to me by the School Board Association, and Mr. Schneiderwin from the MSBA is here to provide some testimony. What this bill does is modify the procedures for termination and discharge, I guess I would like to ask Mr. Schneiderwin if he'd be willing to talk a little bit about the maybe the impetus of the bill and why it's here, and just talk a little bit about the details. So I'd like to turn it over to him.
Mr. Schneiderwin?
Yeah. Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderwin. I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to thank Senator Hand for bringing this forward and the committee's time to hear this. And this is an issue that, as many of you know, we have a very grassroots process in the development of our legislative platform, and this is one of those issues that has come from a local school board in the metro area who has had some challenges with the arbitration process in terms of dismissing teachers. And one of the issues that I understand that this is, can be perceived as an approach to remove teachers, but there's two different ways to improve teacher quality, and one of those is through more training, staff development that you guys have been talking about the last few days on that piece. And the other piece is to look at the teachers who are not being effective in the classroom. And that's one of the issues that this piece addresses. And we know that national leaders and the governor have talked about removing ineffective teachers in the classroom as a method by which we can improve instruction. And that's one of these issues. That's what this bill is attempting to do. And so the complaints that we've heard from our school board members is the issue of the timeliness, the length, the cost, the process that occurs in the dismissal of teachers. And so really what this bill does in very general terms is it simplifies the process for non-probationary teacher discharge. So this would not be your first 3 years. It'd be the non-probationary period be after those 3 years. It does remove the option for arbitration while retaining the right to have a hearing before the school board. In the case of dismissal, also retains the 6-month time period for corrective action. So if an administrator determines that a teacher, based on data analysis or inefficiency, is not being effective in the classroom, the principal or the superintendent would provide a corrective action plan for 6 months under which that teacher would fix his or her deficiencies. That would be a part of this as well. So, and then the piece also, there's two different levels. There's a sub 9 and sub 10 on or sub 13 on immediate discharge, and it still retains the right to an arbitrator under sub 13, and also changes the way the arbitrator is selected. Rather than by lot now, it randomly selects them. And so then the exclusive rep and the board would still have an opportunity to strike the names. It certainly shortens the timelines for the process, which we've heard from members. And then also it changes the standard for the lesser penalty, where if a case goes to an arbitrator now, and it's less than what the board was seeking. Let's say a board was seeking complete termination, but the arbitrator came back under sub 13 and said, no, it should be a 5-day suspension or a 1-month suspension. Instead of having one side agree to that, it means that both sides. So there's a local control, local buy-in from the board and the affected employee for both parties. Now, I understand, and I've talked to a couple other people, Roger Aronson on this issue as well, who deals in this area, and we understand that this issue, he's in agreement that this piece needs to be shortened in some way and simplified for school boards to reduce costs and reduce the time or improve the timeliness of these. And so we're just hopeful that this is one approach to improve teacher quality. Do I expect that this is going to be an issue that is going to open the floodgates for dismissals or discharge? Absolutely not. I mean, I think this is a simple process. I think that they still retain the 6-month corrective action plan. I think that's an important piece because I think most school administrators would tell you that even if a teacher is being inefficient or ineffective in the classroom, that they're willing to sit down and draw up a corrective action plan. And this is what we've got to do to improve student achievement, improve classroom behavior. Whatever the issue is, I think most principals and administrators would be willing to do that. And that's an important piece to consider as well.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Senator Hahn or the witness? We have some folks that would like to testify in opposition. Mr. Aronson. Is he here? Well, if not, Jan Alswager. Or Jess. Is it just Anna? Glover. My. Is the opposition melted away? Or, they thought it was coming at Mr. Aronson. You just about missed your opportunity.
How are you?
Madam Chair, we're doing 747, I assume.
Yes.
Yes.
I apologize for that. In fact, we were out in the hall visiting with some of the other advocates about 747, some of the issues. Mr. Schneiderman and I had visited earlier, and we haven't had the opportunity to go over this with the senator. We want to talk about this bill some more. We think there are some things that we can agree on, some things that we won't agree on, but that we could work this out and maybe have some good things for the senator here and good things for your bill eventually. So that's what we'd like to do. There's some very substantive changes in here. It's a very important statute. That involves a lot of rights and a statute that has a long history that it's done pretty well. So, but we know that we can improve some things, and so that's where we think this should be, Madam Chair. That's sufficient. Would you like
to? So, Mr. Aronson, your proposal is to stall here for a while, huh?
Madam Chair, I took it as that we should just pass the bill and move on, is what I took his comment to be.
Well, let's see. Are there any questions of Mr. Aronson? If not, maybe some will be aroused. Ms. Alswager, why don't you come to the table and testify? Maybe pretty soon we'll get some dialogue from the committee here as well. Ms. Alswager.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we meet again, Senator Hahn. This is the second time today that we've been together. We would basically say the same thing as Mr. Aronson, that there are some issues with the bill, and we would like to work with some of the other individuals that are supporting the bill, because we do have some significant concerns about the bill, and we think that we can work on some of those and possibly bring those back. As far as the details of the bill, if you have some technical questions, we have an attorney here that could answer them, but this is a very technical bill. There's a lot of history with the practice of this bill, so I'm not able to answer all those, but I have somebody here who could if you have questions.
There is a change. I know that this is discharge, and I think you're changing from April 1st to July 1st. Is that a significant change?
Madam Chair,
it would get beyond the school year before doing it. What do you,
Madam Chair, could you enlighten us
about that?
And members, this is a bifurcated discharge process. It has two big sections in it, notice of deficiency discharge and then immediate discharge. Immediate discharge is self-defining. It means exactly that. The notice of deficiency discharge is a separate kind, and if you peel through the statute, it's effective at the close of the school year.
Okay.
So if someone's fired for immoral conduct, they're done the day that matter is done. But if it's for inefficiency or the other pieces that are in there, that discharge is effective at the end of the school year. On that notice of deficiency discharge, for whatever reason, some years ago, the statute was crafted to say that process had to be completed by April 1st. We're not sure why. Maybe school got out earlier years ago. But as we've talked about it, to be fair, we can't think of any policy reason to have that be April 1st. There's some tactical reasons that the employees like, that we like on that. But as a policy matter, July 1st probably makes more sense. I mean, that's why I think that's the answer on that.
Are there any other questions you have of explanation, or shall we let them continue? Senator Hahn, are you willing to work on this a little further?
Madam Chair, yes. I'd also gotten a note. I have not had a chance to talk today with Mr. Kite from MASA, who had brought some language. I think it was intended to be an amendment, but I have not been able to determine what it is exactly that he would like to do. So I think he has some question, but I haven't talked to him. So I think there are some other ideas out there that people are potentially wanting to talk about, and I'm willing certainly to keep talking about this as we go forward.
So you would recommend that we just lay this on the table and you continue to work, and when you have some suggestions to bring it back before the committee?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, this does not have to go to another committee, so that would be my preference.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, it's me.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, before, I know you're getting ready to do that and you're going to keep working on it. One of the questions I will have, because this is a subject I say near and dear to my heart, I carried the Fair Dismissal Act back in the 80s, and I remember the day well because it passed unanimously in the Minnesota House. I should say the other body. And so I'm just concerned about the selection of the arbitrator. I shouldn't say so much concerned as just puzzled a little bit about the changes there. So if you can maybe address what the need is to change to the, instead of each side striking, if they can't agree on one, then I think right now today they each strike a name until there's that fifth one is left, and that's who the arbitrator is. But where am I looking? It's on page 4, I guess. And now you're saying it should be randomly selected. I'm not sure. I mean, I understand what that means, but I don't know if that's putting a bunch of lottery balls in a thing and spinning them around and coming up with an arbitrator, or how different that would be. And I'd like to know what the various sides to this issue think about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Aronson.
I think that the idea there, the one that you're drawing the attention to, I don't think that changes current practice. I think the idea there, the BMS has a panel of arbitrators, 10 selected by the School Board Association, as I understand it, and 10 selected by admin or nominated by. And BMS draws those randomly when you request the panel. And I don't know that that's actually in the statute anywhere before that they do that. I think they do that by their own rule in the BMS and 179A and the rules that accompany that. But I think that's what that refers to. But the statute does make a fundamental, or the proposal does make a fundamental change that you're referring to, and it would take away arbitration in the notice of deficiency proceedings. And that I think that's what you're interested in. That's a very significant change that arbitration would no longer, if this were adopted, arbitration would be taken away in a significant number of the cases, and it would go revert to an old model where the school board technically was designed to hear the charges, and then they would issue the charges, then they'd hear the case, and they'd make the decision. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said that actually doesn't work. There's a little unfairness about that, so you have to use an independent hearing officer model. And that's what's getting pulled back in, is that old independent hearing officer model. It gets really complex. That's why we're saying we might want to visit about this a little bit so we can make a nice presentation to you so you really understand what policy decisions you're going to make on this.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Glover, would you like to address this as well?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just joined up here to reiterate what Roger was pointing out to you. I don't think the randomly selected language on page 4 affects the process all that much, but it is questioned whether or not that list of 10 arbitrators that are familiar with teacher discharge and termination would be the list that we would be picking from or not. I don't think that's clear from this language, but the significant arbitrator change is to that notice discharge. Go away.
Thank you.
So we will lay this on the table for consideration when we hear from you. Thank you, Senator Hand. Thank you, Tess Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator.
Senator Hand, you have Senate File 622.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I think the last bill we just talked about was fairly complex, complicated, had a long history. This is less so. Senate File 622 is very simple. It refers to the procedure by which we establish standards, academic standards, curriculum standards in the state of Minnesota, and adds a provision shown on page 2, section H, that is simply prohibiting the Commissioner of Education from adopting Common Core standards in the subject and school year listed in the revision cycle. That's all it does. And the intent here is to try to preserve the governance of our curriculum and our standards within the purview of this legislature and of the state of Minnesota. And what we, I think there's been efforts at the federal level over time to begin to have a more expansive role in what the federal government believes to be a necessity to govern curriculum and to perhaps impose their views on curriculum on states. I think that is something that I believe that we ought to avoid if possible. And I think that by putting this provision in law, that would prohibit our, whoever the commissioner may be from going down that path without the acknowledgement or consent of the legislature.
Senator Sieben?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, would there be any danger of losing any federal funding if we adopted this?
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, I'm not sure if I can answer that forever and ever into the future. I suppose it's conceivable if at some point the federal government said federal funds would be tied to something, then yes, I guess that's potentially possible. That's not a large concern, frankly, from purposes of this bill. I think that the idea that we should be trying to conform to a federal set of expectations simply because they want to contribute some money to our education is not a sufficient reason, in my view. I think it's more important that we retain the ability to manage expectations and governance of education in Minnesota.
Senator Hand, this is kind of an interesting provision because Common Core standards are not technically federal standards. that they were, I think, I don't know if it was initiated or if the federal government encouraged states to get together and come up with common core standards. So technically, these have been developed and agreed upon by states, and there's not I don't know if they've had 100%, but somebody else can add in on this. I think at issue is when we had the race to the top, one of the provisions for entry was that you had to agree to the Common Core standards. And one could see that even though these are supposedly state-developed to get past that disagreement with the federal government dictating the standards to the states, you can see it moving to the states, the federal government using the dollars, just as you say, as a threat if you don't have them. And then they technically become federal standards. And I think that's what your intent is of trying to see if we were dealing with that in No Child Left Behind. If you don't do as we say, you'll lose all of your Title I and all of these other monies, and you're caught. So, Senator Vanoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Hahn, I don't agree. And I think that this isn't a Republican or Democratic issue. I think people feel differently on both sides of the aisle. I remember being at an NCSL event and being pretty much on my own with where I stood, which I'm kind of used to. But I don't agree because I think the rationale behind the Common Core standards is that we have a high standard for an American student, and that we say in our country that if you graduate from our schools, you can count on it being the highest standard, no matter if you live in Arkansas, Minnesota, Nebraska. And so there's been a tremendous amount of work done by the state chiefs and by the Governors Association. And our own former commissioner, Alice Segrin, was one of the pioneers who was on that committee and helped design those standards. And she worked very hard and believed strongly in them. I know that Commissioner Segrin had concern about the mathematics standards because she's felt as though our standards were not as high, higher than the Common Core. But I remember Commissioner Segrin sitting at that table saying that there was a provision even in race to the top where you could opt out up to 15% higher, and there were ways that if you were higher, you'd be exempted. Recently, when we were in Washington, D.C., former Governor Jeb Bush talked about the importance of the Common Core standards in terms of both elevating all standards but also the potential for cost savings when you think about how much is made in curriculum and publishing these, you know, this school likes this picture and this school likes this sentence, and what that money could be devoted to if we could agree on a very high standard. I understand we don't want the federal government telling us what's a Minnesota education, and so I would expect that we would have ways to opt out if we do choose higher, but I would hate to see in law a prohibition, because I would trust that we would be at the table arguing for what we believe are in the best interest of Minnesotans. So I think this goes too far, and I appreciate the intent to never lower a Minnesota standard, but I'm concerned about this direction.
Madam Chair, just a brief response, and I appreciate, Senator Bonhoeff, your position. I disagree. I do think that there is a critical distinction. We have in our Constitution, in Minnesota's Constitution, a provision that says that we are responsible for education. There is no such provision in the federal Constitution at all. There is no mention of education in the federal Constitution. And it's not because they didn't believe education was important. They certainly did. In fact, they wrote a statement about it in the Northwest Ordinance, was adopted the same year as the Constitution. So it's not that they were unaware of or diminished the importance of education, but what they did believe is that it's something that should be governed by the states. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the years is the federal government has become increasingly a player. And I accept your point that we, as United States citizens, we want our education system to be the best. I don't believe that is accomplished by having the federal government become the major or the dominant player in what that looks like or what those standards ought to be. I think it is more efficient, and it is likely to yield better results if we allow individual states to manage this. which has been our practice. I think we need to continue to do that. And I am concerned that as this goes along, we are going to be lured by the attraction of federal money to cede that right. I frankly have been learning in my last few months here in the course of the work in the healthcare committee how damaging that is. Once you go down the path of saying, well, we're going to allow the federal government to give us money with conditions attached to it, after a while, you're not in control of your own budget anymore. You're not in control of your own process and policies anymore. And I think we've gone way down that path in healthcare too far. I do not want to see us do that in education. I think this is a very small, I think, needed step to at least say that we're not going to do that with this. So
just to follow up, Madam Chair, just follow up.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I think that Congressman Klein would be on your side. So I think, in that sense, that we may not go as far down this road as we might have had that change not happened. I think you make a compelling argument. I just, again, just concerned about the rigidity of the statement, but thank you.
Is there a Senator Wicker? Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've kind of been on both sides of this issue. I was not in favor of the Common Core standards. And then I had the opportunity to kind of be somewhat open to it at the same conference out in Washington, D.C., and visiting with a number of, well, first of all, Madam Chair, you're correct. It really wasn't, it's not really the Common Core standards of the federal government. It's really the Common Core standards of groups of states that have gotten together and identified that those core standards that they support. And I think the issue can be argued about, will those standards be high enough or where those standards might be set. But one of the benefits of having more unified core standards is that private industry, primarily the knowledge industry, the people who make technology training, whether it's books or e-books or whatever, to provide a larger base to sell that information to. Currently, when they have to look at each individual state as having different standards, they quite often will step back and say it's not to our financial benefit to publish or create innovative kinds of technology training programs or teaching programs for that individual state. But if they had a group of states, and I was visiting with them out in Washington, where they have groups of states, or in the case of the Common Core standards, it would be very beneficial, and we could have those industries put together a lot of high-tech kinds of programs for our schools. And I, would concur that I would hope that Minnesota standards would always be high or higher than whatever those standards might be. But I do think it could be beneficial in the sense, and financially beneficial, for states to give a larger base to sell that, generate that technology, educational technology for, and sell it for. And that's the reason I kind of came all the way around and believe that if we want to move forward, that's one way that we can do it.
So, and Senator Hahn and Senator Stumpf, I think if perhaps that hadn't become a proviso of the Race to the Top application, it might have been something that more naturally occurred as agreements among the states. There's some of us that would really love it if the federal government would fund special education and then stop looking for other ways to send pieces of money and then tie strings to it that just make life more difficult for us. I think we would actually we would do it for the right reasons and find ways to achieve that without them getting involved. And I think that's the concern that Senator Hand is bringing forward on this. Are there any other? Dr. Ephraim, would like to testify in this?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, women and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim, and I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch, and we are absolutely delighted to support this bill. This is much needed, both from the constitutional and sovereignty issues that Senator Hahn has raised and from the quality of the standards that are being put out. And I want to talk about those sovereignty and state control issues first, because they are incredibly important. Not only has the Common Core standards become an absolute requirement of Race to the Top that was required to be adopted verbatim, that had to be, that they said, oh, yeah, you can put in 15% of your own stuff, but it was required to be adopted verbatim. The Obama administration blueprint for the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind for the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was putting out funds that, or putting out the proposal that Title I funds be required, be tied to the adoption of college and career ready standards, i.e. national standards. Back in 2008, the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association, who also gave us the Common Core standards, who also gave us the idea for Goals 2000, who also gave us the idea for No Child Left Behind, put out a report called Benchmarking for Success, Ensuring Students Receive a World-Class Education. And they said, quote, the federal government should offer a range of tiered incentives to make the next stage of the journey easier, end quote. So they are talking about not only national benchmarks, but international benchmarks, which, again, is totally away from the constitutional idea of federalism. And finally, I would say that the American Federation of Teachers has just put out a huge manifesto signed by people from multiple other groups and corporations saying that there should be voluntary curriculum to go along with the so-called voluntary Common Core standards. And the last part of their, the last point of their recommendation says, quote, increasing federal investments in implementation support, i.e., tie federal money to the adoption of national standards. That is not voluntary, and that is a huge interference in state sovereignty when it comes to national standards and or to standards and education. And then in comparative international studies related to curriculum and instruction and in evaluations aimed at finding the most effective curriculum sequences, curriculum materials, curricular designs, and instructional strategies. So they want the federal government to take control of this. And so this legislation is absolutely necessary. Now, from a quality standpoint, I want to say that the English language standards of the Common Core that were unfortunately adopted by the department without really any legislative input over the last summer during the campaign of 2010 were widely panned, including by Sandra Stotsky, who is on the Massachusetts State School Board, and who had been invited to be an expert commentator on the English language arts standards when they were changed in 2003 or 2004. And she basically said that they were not worthy of being called national standards, that they were content-free, and had multiple other bad things to say about them. James Milgram, a professor of mathematics at the at Stanford University, was also on that validation committee, and he said of the math standards that it appeared that the decision had already been made to not adopt the highest and develop the highest standards already present in states like Minnesota and other states around the country, as well as the highest performing nations. So, and both of those people were on the validation committee for the final version of the Common Core standards, and they refused to sign off on them. So, from both a quality and a sovereignty standpoint, this is absolutely needed. Thank you.
Are there any questions? You know, it's you're taking the approach of not allowing this to happen in the process of revision of existing standards. So it is, right now, the ability to adopt the Common Core standards rests with the department rather than with the legislature. Senator Hand, is that the case? And that's what is that what you're trying to say? That in other words, if the Common Core standards are to be adopted, it should be done by the legislature rather than in a de facto way in the revision process?
Madam Chair, essentially, yes. We have a process. Some of us were here when we went through the adoption of the standards initially. It's a process that can be contentious. I think it is one that we need to preserve as the in Minnesota, and it has to, I believe, have some oversight by the legislature. And so the intent here is to create a prohibition from having standards adopted by the commissioner and brought to the state and implemented without the ability for the legislature to have their say and perhaps change that. So, yes, that's the intent.
So, Senator Hand, is it the case in your view, then, that now the Commissioner of Education could, in fact, adopt these? You're tying it to when they come up for review, that they could be put in place of the current standards. If they come up, can the Commissioner or the Department of Education adopt these standards separate from that process?
Madam Chair, I don't think so. I hope that's not the case. My understanding is that the process we have in statute requires curriculum to be adopted on a prescribed schedule, and if we adopted standards outside of that, I would suspect they would be in violation of the law.
Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anyone from the Commissioner's office that could share their perspective?
Shackleton.
Brian Shackleton, Department of Education. You know, we don't have a position on this bill. We are certainly are looking at it. It would affect some of what we do, but at this point, we're not taking a position on it.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shackleton, when would you anticipate having a position since this is center stage?
We don't have a timeline, Madam Chair, Senator. We don't have a timeline at this point. There are a lot of big bills that are kind of moving through the process right now, and this is one amongst many. So,
Madam Chair.
Interesting.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and perhaps Senator Hand talked about this, but I missed it. Can you distinguish from these expressions, let's see, revise and align standards versus adopting Common Core standards? Can you That's the language in you, that you're adding here. Can you explain how adopting Common Core standards relates to the schedule that's in statute today?
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, my reading of the statute today is that the department, the commissioner, is required to review and revise standards to be in line with or revise curriculum to be in line with our standards, to do that periodically.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's conceivable that the commissioner could set up a process to review, and that the what are called Common Core standards could be a part of that. That's possible, I suspect. But what this is designed to do is to prevent the commissioner acting to adopt a set of standards for the purpose of securing, for example, federal money, or to secure some other benefit that may be offered, but instead to follow the process that we have defined in statute, and trusting that as that goes forward, that the legislature would have an opportunity to weigh in on that.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
So, Madam Chair, it's not your intent to interfere with the schedule and having the commissioner of the department review the standards. I don't know. I think you maybe could say it more clearly. I mean, I'm not real keen on adopting something from Washington in lots of ways. So, you know, I think I probably share some concern about that with you, but I don't want us to interfere with our development of standards as a state.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, it's not my intention to interfere with the current process that we have. This is, in fact, intended to not interfere with that, but to preserve that as a prerogative of the state of Minnesota, and to prevent some other process or other way of getting academic standards implemented in the Minnesota curriculum.
So, Senator Hand, can I just, on that point, the English language arts standards were adopted by this procedure?
Madam Chair, that is my understanding.
Yes. When they were up for review and they adopted the Common Core standard for that particular provision. So that would appear, I think what Senator Hand is saying, we're not sure we want it. This is a pattern in the revision process doing this, that it should have some oversight from the legislature. We know what's happening and have a say in it, because there are a number of implications.
And Madam Chair, it probably would have been easier for someone like myself to understand if we just kind of said it that way and said that the legislature, you know, would have oversight or whatever. So, but I understand now what you're getting at. Thank you.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hunt, I too would have been more amenable to it if it stated that the intent was that there was legislative oversight. I know this is being laid over for possible inclusion. You might consider massaging the language so it's a little more friendly.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I could certainly work with council and staff to see if there's some other language that might be more amenable.
Yeah.
Happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Then if there are no further discussion, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hand. The last bill is one that we had to delay the other evening when we had a little bit over jammed schedule, and that's Senator Sendrum's Senate File 641. Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be here before the Education Committee. I was thinking back. I don't recall that in 9 years I've been before the Education Committee, but
welcome.
Every day is a first, so here we go. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 641 is a bill that, at least to me, feels somewhat special, and I think it's somewhat special in that as I think about this driving down the road, it's the kind of bill that maybe if we're able to enact, 10 years from now, it's going to have a lot. We're going to be able to look back and say, you know, this bill really had a lot of effect on the lives of kids, and even moreover, I think perhaps on the lives of people that contribute to scholarship funds that will help kids across Minnesota as they're endeavoring in their educational process. So it is exciting, at least to me, and I hope to you as we go through it today. But it's a chance, Madam Chair, I think, to give children, especially and moreover, exclusively to low-income children, to have some opportunities with respect to educational choices that they might not otherwise have. And so this bill involves a scholarship process wherein individuals would be able to contribute to scholarship funds across Minnesota, receive a tax credit on up to 80%, and that money then would go to fund educational scholarships for low-income children across Minnesota. It's been done in a couple of other states rather successfully. I think in Arizona in 2007, $98 million came into their scholarship fund, I think it was about 700,000 contributors were involved in that. And Pennsylvania has been very effective, and I believe Florida has as well, and there may be more that I'm not aware of. But again, Madam Chair, I hope that we can give this bill a due consideration. I think it's an exciting bill in many ways, and to carry forward on the explanation, I would ask Jim Fields to assume the position of presenter and to move this bill forward from the standpoint of explaining it further to you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Fields.
Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to bring this. We've been working on this many years and think we're ready to bring it. I must apologize for my voice. It's a little low, so I'm going to get right close to the mic. Senate File 641 is an opportunity for the state to...
Can you, I think you pull back just a little bit.
Okay.
And Madam Chair.
That's fine. Thank you.
I forgot a certain point. In order to get the bill in order, I would have an oral amendment if I could offer that from the standpoint of just doing that up front. And I have to do it orally because it didn't get done in writing, but it's rather simple. And it would be on to delete lines 820 to 823, which have to do with caps relative to the contribution caps. If somebody would be so kind as to move to delete that, the bill would be in order insofar as the author is concerned.
Senator Nino moves the author's amendment to delete on page 8, line 21. Line 23. Is that an accurate? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill speaks to low-income families, Minnesota's low graduation and rate and the gap that we suffer from. It can be used to support kids in preschool if they they go to a charter school, a public school, or a non-public school, and if they meet the requirement, which is free and reduced lunch standards. It helps K-12 scholarships for non-public schools, and that is for children that are 1.5 times free and reduced lunch eligibility. It helps charter schools who have 30% free and reduced lunch children, and that money goes towards improving their education offerings. The tax credit is, like the senator said, 80%. So if, Madam Chair, you give $1,000 to a scholarship program now, your subtraction from your state income tax would be $80, somewhere in there. If this bill goes through, the subtraction would be, and you give $1,000, your subtraction from your tax bill would be $800. Basically, the bill in other states, and by the way, Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana have this program, it increases personal giving and corporate giving to scholarships. It saves the state money because basically the givers, the private school family, which would be other givers, the church, pay for the education of the child instead of the state taxpayers. The committee should have a sheet that looks like this, and I could run down the numbers real quick. And this is not from the government. This is a piece that we put together from the Minnesota Independent School Forum. So these are all averages. So if you look at the current picture, $7,150 is the average for general education revenue. And most of us in this room know that actually in Minneapolis now, it's really costs an average of $21,000 to educate a child. $2,050 of that $7,150 is special education and other revenue, and we took that out because private school students do receive educational special education monies or services, and we're glad we do that. So that total is $9,200. The local share of that is about $3,500. So if you look down to the next bubble, the maximum scholarship is 70% of the general education revenue, which is $5,000. And the tax credit that people would get would be $4,000. So then if you look at the savings bubble on the bottom, $7,150 is a general, that money would not be spent now by the state taxpayers. And if you subtracted what the state gave the giver for the credit, $4,000, it means for every student that became a non-public ed student, it would save the state $3,150.
Senator Steven?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry to interrupt your testimony, sir. That's okay. I was just wondering to reflect this then. Do we have a fiscal note on the bill to show those savings to the state?
I'm told that it will create a revenue note, and they would complete that when it gets to taxes. This bill has to go to taxes.
So, Madam Chair, is the bill going to be... What's your intention with the bill in terms of putting it in the omnibus bill? Or
no, it will go to taxes.
I see.
Taxes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Just quickly, the foundation, a foundation has to serve more than two schools, and the foundation would register with the Department of Revenue. The giver would register his or her intent to give the money, and then there would probably be a number exchange that hasn't been worked out yet. And then the giver files that number and receipt from the foundation with their income tax. We have a few people who would like to testify for this bill. I'd like to call up Harrison Grodnick.
Grodnick, welcome to the committee, and if you'd just say your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Harrison Grodnick.
Proceed.
Should I begin? It reminds me of Sir George Jessel. I don't know if anyone's familiar with him, but yes. He was once quoted as saying the human brain is a truly remarkable organ. It begins working from the moment we're born, and it never stops until you're asked to speak in public. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. It's truly my pleasure to be here, and it's my honor to share my personal experience with regards to this bill. One of my sets of grandparents escaped Auschwitz before they came to our country. My other set of grandparents came through Ellis Island only to be met by the Great Depression. And amidst all of this, I was always taught the importance of charitable giving as a way to celebrate the greatness of our country and the spirit of being an American citizen. When I was growing up, I went through public schools, and I had a number of friends. And I always remembered many of my friends who were great people and came from lower economic backgrounds and had challenges of coming from either a single parent or a no-parent household. And I always remembered how great they were, but how their hurdles in life were much more significant than my hurdles. As I went on through school and life and was able to donate and give to a charitable cause, I found a charity that allowed me to find students that reminded me a lot of my friends that had great character but had hurdles that, again, were significantly high. And for the last many years, I've been contributing through these scholarships and have been able to be a part of many of these young kids' lives, where I get to watch them and see how they progress through school. And it is without question that I have received much more from our deal than they have by me giving to them. And so I'm here to testify because Jim shared with me this bill, and I reflect on what I give today and what I would be able to financially give tomorrow should these kind of tax credits be allowed. And I welcome the opportunity to give more. And this would allow me to do so, and I know there's a lot of other people who feel the same way. So I'm simply here to share my personal experience, and I thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions, Senator Bonner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Senjum, I support the bill, and Mr. Grodnick, thank you for being here to share your story. I have a question, though, Senator Senjum. I noticed you've got the charter schools in here, but those are schools that are part of the public school system, and students don't pay, and so I'm assuming that that's to offset maybe extra expenses, whatever, but then I'm wondering, I know we have foundations in some of the public schools that give scholarships to kids to be able to participate in extracurricular activities who wouldn't be able to. Are you open to including those as part of this bill as well?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, you know, I think that's the intent, and I think that's the intent as Jim developed these ideas that would occur. We want to give all kids a chance.
Well, Senator Bonhoff, I'm not sure how this interplays with if you expand it into the public sector. We do have both a tax credit and tax deduction and credit bill. It's been kind of eroded a bit, but in the tax credit, it doesn't cover tuition. That was one thing that wasn't achieved. In tax deduction, it does, but it's available to public school as well as private school parents and to cover all kinds of extra educational expenses. So low-income people can access our current tax credit law rather than it being going through a scholarship fund. This is a little bit different mechanism for getting it to a particular particular audience, but we do have that as well, and I think at some point we ought to revisit and see how that is performing and whether in fact it needs to be updated and strengthened.
And Madam Chair, though, I still then don't understand what the charter school piece is in this puzzle.
Madam Chair?
I think Senator Gene Piccolo is coming up next, and maybe he has something to add to this. Should we leave that burden with him?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you. Mr. Piccolo?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few brief comments about the equity and Opportunity in Education Tax Credit. The Minnesota Association of Charter Schools supports this legislation for three reasons. First, it provides another way for people and corporations to demonstrate tangible support for two sectors of public education, public preschools and public charter schools. Second, it targets the qualified tax credit donations on educational opportunity for low-income students, which is a matter of funding equity. For public charter schools, this credit would provide a means to raise additional funds, as charter schools do not have local levy authority, to bridge the funding gap that is growing between traditional school districts and charter schools. Statewide now, that gap in funding is 14%, and in our core city districts, in St. Paul it's 17%, and in Minneapolis 21%. So that's part of the reason for charter schools being part of this thing. Third, this bill focuses resources raised through the tax credit on low-income students in two sectors of public education where there is a great need. For example, charter schools have and continue to serve significantly higher percentages of low-income, free and reduced students than traditional districts. In the 2008 Office of Legislative Audit report, they indicated that 53% of the students in charter schools were low-income students qualifying for free and reduced. This year, according to MDE, 56% of the students in charter schools are free and reduced students. And finally, we support this because we believe this will provide public charter schools and public preschools an ability to enhance the learning experiences for low-income kids and to ensure that those resources are actually spent on those low-income kids through the strong accountability measures in this legislation. So again, thank you for the opportunity to briefly share our position on this legislation to provide greater equity and resources for and learning opportunities for our low-income kids in public schools.
Thank you, Mr. Bicklow. Other questions? Next is Mitch Perlstein.
Madam Chairman,
welcome, Dr. Committee.
How are you? Pleasure to be here again. Madam Chair, members, my name is Mitch Perlstein, and I'm founder and president of Center of the American Experiment, a think tank which opened up shop in Minneapolis 21 years ago last Saturday. My previous education-related lives included time on the staff of the University of Minnesota.
Dr. Perlstein, so yeah. It has come of age, right?
I'm sorry?
It has come of age.
It has come of age, yes.
Congratulations.
Oh, it is now of drinking age in the state of Minnesota.
Dr. Perlstein.
Yes.
Sorry to mess
it's
up your
quite all
testimony.
Right, but I'll always sacrifice a line for a laugh. My background is with President C.P. McGraw at the University of Minnesota. I served on the staff of Minnesota Governor Al Quie, as well as in the research arm of the U.S. Department of Education. And my doctorate's in educational administration, but particularly germane, given the subject at hand, I was privileged to serve as chairman of Minnesotans for School Choice when Governor Arne Carlson and some legislative champions, including our chair, demonstrated great courage and tenacity in passing a path-breaking education tax credit law, a tax deduction law, 14 years ago now, in 1997, which is another way of saying I especially appreciate the chance to speak on behalf of Senate File 641. Also pertinent, but much more up-to-date, and as I mentioned when I testified on alternative teacher certification 2 months ago, I'm finishing a book. Actually, the publisher has it right now, that connects five dots that have never been adequately connected before. Family breakdown, how that leads to educational weakness, how that leads to economic weakness, how that in turn leads to a loss of both personal and national economic competitiveness, and how all that inescapably is leading to deepening class divisions in a country which has never liked thinking of itself as demarcated in such ways. The entirety of which adding one more dot for our purposes this afternoon leads to a pivotal question. What kind of education might work best for boys and girls not only tied down by poverty, but also frequently tied up and held back by too many loose ends in their young lives? The short answer, of course, is there is no one kind to the exclusion of all others, public or private. Though when I was here in February, I focused on how certain unusually intensive public schools, often charters and characterized as paternalistic, are serving lower income students exceptionally well. But as I also argue in the book, there is a second type of educational setting which research makes clear often holds extra promise for children, often in greatest need. This, for example, is how Professor Paul Peterson of Harvard, but more importantly, originally from Montevideo, Minnesota, along with his colleague William Howell, in 2006 summed up a stream of findings from several privately funded scholarship programs around the country aimed at low-income students. Especially noteworthy, they wrote, was the positive impact on African-American test scores, which was consistent, they added, with other research showing that African-American students tend to do better in private rather than public schools, not just in terms of test scores, but also in regards to educational attainment, which is another way of saying high school graduation rates, likelihood of pursuing an advanced degree, and future earnings. Even studies that find little comparable benefits for white students, they concluded, generally show that private schools help African-American boys and girls. None of this, I assure you, is meant to beat up on public schools and the legions of superb and saintly educators who serve in them. And this is the case for no other reason than I have never spent a single day as a private school student in my whole life, with the admitted exception of a driver's education course in about 1965 at the Hebrew Institute of Long Island. But there is compelling evidence, going back to James Coleman's seminal work a generation and more ago, that for many students, albeit certainly not all, what works best for them are private, including religiously grounded schools, for whatever the reason or reasons might be. Now, I might point out here, by the way, that some of the most acute writing on this very question was done by our late friend and colleague, John Brandel, who I'm guessing was a member of this committee 30 years ago. Given that we know all this, I would respectfully suggest that we owe it to low-income students and their parents to embrace the expanded freedom and options for learning that would be made possible by the bill you're considering today. And for that matter, I would argue that we also owe it to ourselves and to our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Perlstein. Any questions?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sanjam, I have a question about the 80%. I was trying to do a quick research on tax credits and the percentages, and I find that they go kind of from 15% to 35% maximum. This is 80%. So if we're successful in doing something like you describe and we get $95 million, the state of Minnesota would have to come up with $78 million in order to have the budget for that tax credit. And, you know, 80% seems quite high. So I suppose this is going to be a discussion that goes in the tax committee, but I was just wondering why the 80% and kind of what is the reasoning behind an 80%? It seems like more than double, almost triple of what we usually do.
Senator Sanjam.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray, my sense is that is probably what other states have done. But I would like to defer this to Mr. Field, who did most of the background work on this in terms of developing it. I would say, though, part of the 80% is to create some excitement and to bring some money into this process. And certainly it will be all negotiated one way or another in tax committee. There's an affordability issue here that we have to deal with, but we're at least at this committee trying to kind of move through the general philosophy of doing this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator St. John. Actually, that is, I agree with you that, you know, as a donor, I would be, you know, 80% is it's a big deal. So if you get 80% back, this is, will be my preference. But in terms of how that plays out with having the funding available at the state level to make up for that tax reduction, I mean, you almost have to have that excitement will generate a tremendous problem for us in terms of really having that funding, because you will receive a lot of funding when you have a number like this. And so the state is going to have to come up with, and I think Senator Sieben was getting to that point of, you know, what is the plan for you to have kind of the option here, because I think you are going to generate a lot of excitement in terms of contributions for an 80% tax credit.
Mr. Field, would you like to respond as Senator? I presume, and maybe you could address the, is there a lag between the state giving the credit and the savings that is that exceeds that by your estimate of $3,150 exceeds, goes beyond, repays that plus the $3,150 for the state. Is there a time lag there?
Yes, Madam Chair. We put in the bill that it would start this year in July. So I imagine the first year would be pretty slow. And then the foundation has to let the money out, I think it's in 2 years. And so the savings to the state in terms of the education budget would probably come a year and a half after the bill goes into law. In terms of the percent, I know there's one state that has 50%. I think Arizona was higher, and I'm sure Pennsylvania is higher also. In Pennsylvania, it's only corporate gifts. There's, if I could talk a little more, one of the good things about this bill is no matter if the school is charter, public, or private, in Arizona there was a lot of people that donated to it, and I think it's very healthy for this state to involve more people in their local schools or the schools they want to support, because then they have, you know, a dollar in the game, and they're going to pay more attention to the product, and it's really kind of builds more of a neighborhood feeling for schools.
Thank you. Senator
yes.
Nelson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a comment for the committee, just to kind of put this in context, the 80% number. I believe our current K-12 credit for education expenses is 75%. I mean, we know there's a lot of qualifiers there, but I believe it's currently 75.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there, let's see, who's next? Jim Bartholomew?
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And most of what I was going to say has already been said, so I'll be brief. But I want to thank Senator St. John for carrying the bill. We're very supportive and hope you'll be able to adopt it as well, primarily because it does help directly support and improve the educational opportunities for low-income students. And we suggest it's also a vehicle to help improve the education for all students. And much has been said already about trying to expand access to quality preschool programming. I think Senator Bonhoeff left, but in regard to charter schools, they do have some unique financial challenges that other district schools don't have. And then we think it's important to help low-income families and students find the school that best meets their needs. And I, in regard to scholarships being a strategy for helping to improve broader public education, there was a study that just came out last month that's fairly representative of a broad body of research over the last few years that shows that tax scholarships in this regards has been a significant boost for public schools. And it was just released. They looked at over 7 years and 92% of all students in Florida, but 7 years of data looking at the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program. And they found that the program had a marked positive effect on the academic performance of students who remain in the public schools. And they saw the biggest impact on public schools that served a disproportionately large number of low-income students. And they go on to talk about some of the rationale they think that's the case. But overall, we just want to send the message that this is a wonderful way to directly support and improve the educational opportunities for low-income kids and education broadly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Rabbi Bernstein?
Thanks, Jim.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Joshua Bornstein. I work for a school, Torah Academy. It's a private Jewish school in St. Louis Park. And I think one of the things I wanted to just bring out is how many families that I see on a daily basis need this kind of opportunity. Private schools sometimes puts up a picture in people's heads of wealthy going to their own schools and enjoying what they want. In our school, 90% of our families are on some sort of financial assistance. Between 30 and 40% are at the poverty level. And the last few years, we've had numerous families go from being reasonable tuition payers to really, really struggling families who've been out of work for a year, 2 years, families that have lost a house. There are plenty of really hardworking people in Minnesota who have jobs, who work hard, who do not have the finances to have the luxury of going to the school of their choice. And whether it's a religious school, a non-religious school, a Jewish school, Catholic school, whatever it may be, the state is best served if families are invested in the schools that their kids go to. If they feel it's a school that's right for their children, we all gain. There's really no difference to the state whether a kid goes to private or public school. It's a matter of whether they get a good education and whether they become good citizens in our state. And that happens at all of our schools are capable of doing that. And the more the family and the kids feel like they have the right place, the better we will have. That's the picture that we see. Many, many families, again, who middle income, lower middle income, low income, really struggling to have the opportunity. Some don't come to the school because they can't afford it. They don't want to take a big scholarship. There's a limit to what they can stretch themselves to do. This would empower those families to come to the table and feel like they're contributing and they're not pulling all the resources out of the community for themselves. There's plenty of hardship cases. We could discuss them all day long. Every school has them. But understand that most private schools are like us. Most private schools are dealing with regular families that really have an interest in that particular level of education and do everything they can and sacrifice a lot, vacations and a lot of luxuries, just so they can go to a school where they feel their kids will thrive.
Thank you, Rabbi Bernstein. Is there any questions? Thank you very much. Are there any others that wish to testify? Are there any that wish to testify in opposition?
Madam Chair, could I say just a couple more quick things? The association that I represent, the Minnesota Independent School Forum, is the only organization in the state that looks at private school in total. So it's not just the Baptist or the Catholic schools. It's all of us together. So we've studied private schools. And a couple of facts might be helpful. The average private school is around 140 kids. So if you think about that, almost half of the schools have four teachers. The principal drives the bus, teaches math, coaches. And they're in the rural areas, and they've been there for 100 years. If you go to Nicollet, Minnesota, there's a little Lutheran school, and there's a little public school, and it's been that way for a lot of years. In the last 5 years, we've lost 38 private schools. And basically, they're closing because they can't raise enough money to help with tuition of the lower-end economic child and family, and they don't have enough wealthy people in the town or whatever to make up that difference, and this would make a difference to them. The other fact is that The kindergarten class of private schools in Minnesota is 8,000 kids. The senior class, grade 12, is 4,000 kids, actually a little less. The biggest drop is going into high school, ninth grade, and that's where we lose 32% of our kids. And we studied it in 04, and one-third of that was geographic, because the nearest Lutheran High School was too far to get to. The other two-thirds were really basically an economic decision. Once the child leaves the private school and goes to a public school, well, they do have a bigger chance of not graduating, because that's just the statistics. And so I'm going to share that information. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Is there any further questions or discussion? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to offer one small amendment to the bill. I hope the author finds amenable. It's on page 8.1. There's after the word preschool, there's a phrase there that I believe presumes passage of a different bill that we heard in this committee. The Minnesota Early Learning Foundation had a proposal here. And this language, as best I can tell, it presumes that that becomes law, and we can't make that presumption, I don't think. So I would suggest that we just take those words out, the words evaluated to be of high quality and.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would find that acceptable.
Any discussion? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Motion prevails. There's no further discussion. Is there a motion to send this to Tax Committee?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that. I carried this bill in the past. And
okay.
And actually, Senator Senjum, I just have to take you to task. You should have brought it to me, but to sign on, but I think I'm on it now. I think I am.
I was going to say, Senator Scheid.
So I'd like to move that Senate File 641, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, it's been moved that Senate File 641 be passed and sent re-referred to taxes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I make an announcement before we adjourn the committee.
Yes.
I just wanted to remind the committee that on March 21st from 11 to 12 in the North Hall, we will have a display from a unique program called Inside Out, and it's IN and then SCI, SCI, and then ED for Ed, Inside Out. It's a unique collaboration between Mayo Clinic, other science, technology, engineering, and math private firms, working with several schools in Rochester. The students are doing real-life science lab things with scientists. They have been in Washington, D.C., actually, last month, and presented their projects. It's kind of like a hyped-up science fair. And on the 21st, they met with President Obama as well. I'll tell you, on the 21st, they will be here in the North Hall from 11 to 12. They will be bringing their presentations. The scientists will be there as well, the STEM folks and the students and the presentations. And I'd encourage you to put it on your calendars.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Tomorrow, I would like to indicate we will be taking up, we will continue with Senator Hand's agenda.
Portfolio.
Senate File 208 and 618. So, Senator,
Madam Chair,
to defend yourself?
Well, I Mr. Marcus had asked me about 208, and I was just talking to the folks from MASA who will not be available tomorrow, and I'm not sure that would be the best fit for
okay.
them. So if you
well, we may be able to.
If it can't be accommodated any other time, I'll do my best to be on my own. But
okay.
Otherwise,
if not, we'll see if we can accommodate that. And I think there are other bills that we do need to hear as well. So
right.
I'm sorry if we can't get that definitive right now.
Thanks,
Mr. Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to wish Senator Daley a happy birthday and thank him for the trip.
So we're
enjoyed the Special K bars. Grandma's
grandma's specialty.
Wonderful. Thank you, and happy birthday. So if no other business, the meeting is adjourned.